A podcast or the cinema?
My mouth wasn't near the talky part.
Get it together.
Quickly enough, yeah. Hello.
Hi.
It's a podcast.
It is. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. That's Dave White. We're film critics, and we're married to each other.
We write for The Wrap. You do other podcasts. Mm-hmm. I try to stay out of the sun.
Well, this is a good week for that.
This is a really good week for that. It's sunny right now.
Yeah.
But we just had a beautiful week of gray skies and cold
overcast
rain. Wintertime now.
As though it were somewhere else.
Are you feeling anxious?
Me?
Now that December is here? Are you feeling the push, the rush, the crush? Are you feeling like you don't have enough time to enjoy all Christmas activities that you need to enjoy before the actual 25th? I know how you are. I know that you are a person who enjoys the anticipation of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
The Christmassy events and activities that take place before the actual Christmas.
You know, it's funny, and I'm not alone in that. Yesterday, I recorded an episode of the All Things Cozy podcast.
Did you?
I think posting this Sunday.
Yeah.
And Matt Pivovarczyk is the same way. It's all about the buildup. And the day itself inevitably feels a little anticlimactic because it's the
getting. That's not true.
The getting there is so much of the fun part.
The getting there is fun, but the day itself is great. Do you know why?
Why?
It's when you get presents.
Well, there's that.
You know what's great about getting presents?
What?
Everything. I'll tell you another thing. Giving presents to people, really cool. Lots of fun, especially when you're as good at it as I am, and I know exactly how to make your day beautiful with presents.
You are very good at it.
Yeah.
But in answer
I'm
to your...
I'm not bragging here. This is not me being braggy, either humble or otherwise. I'm just saying I've perfected a skill over the years.
You are a very good present giver.
And I
know stocking stuffer.
I know what to do. I know how to do it.
Yes.
And I do it.
To answer your original question, yes, I am feeling a little stressed.
On that day is when you get presents.
Yes.
So that day is not an anticlimax. That's a presents day. That's the explosion.
Fine. I am feeling a little stressed. This happens every year because of the life I have chosen for myself.
Well, that was dumb of you, wasn't it?
Pretty much. Like, being a film critic is already makes your Decembers crazy because, like, there's all these sudden last-minute influx of, like, award season under-the-wire movies. And, yep. Oh, you need to write this list and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then on top of it, I went and wrote a book about Christmas movies.
Why'd you go do that?
I don't know what I was thinking. But that's the kind of thing you can really only promote in the latter part of the year. Nobody really wants to talk about that in April. They really want to talk about it between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So I have arranged to make my favorite time of year also my busiest time of year so that I don't get as much time to enjoy the part that makes it my favorite part of year.
I have an action plan because I'm organized.
Of course you do.
My action plan for you is to force you each day to enjoy some sort of Christmassy activity or moment.
Okay.
So that every day until the 25th, until the day, which is the best day, when you get the presents.
Yes.
Each day, I'm going to make sure, through coercion or some other forceful tactic.
Subterfuge, perhaps.
To get you to enjoy a Christmassy moment or activity.
Okay. I endorse this.
I'm ready to take control of your December. It's going to be good for you. You just relax, and I'll handle these things.
Okay. Madam Full Charge.
For example, I have signed you up to be a disc jockey.
Yes.
To be a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
DJ!
Who's that gigolo on the street?
I've signed you up to be a DJ at the ICA.
Yes.
For the Nayland Blake retrospective.
Now
you're going to do it, and I'm going to do it.
Now, this is a...
Right back to back.
This is
it takes two, baby.
to make a thing go right. This is an exhibition of our friend Nayland Blake's, you know, it's a kind of a career retrospective.
Correct.
And it comes with a, there's this whole like DJ station set up and all of these albums.
Yes.
Now, are the albums... Those
records belong to Nayland.
Okay, that was my question.
Those are Nayland's records.
Now, yeah. In keeping with the exhibition, do I then have to limit myself to Nayland's albums since they are...
You got 30 minutes and you use those records.
Okay, so because the records themselves are part of the installation...
You get there a little bit early.
Nayland is providing the music for the installation and thus... I shouldn't be bringing in my own stuff.
That is correct.
Okay, that's fine. So I'll get there early. I'll comb through because there's a lot. How many albums do you think?
A lot.
Like
rack after hundreds. Rack after rack. Hundreds. Yeah. Minimum hundreds.
Yeah. And Nayland said that I should be playing Christmas music. So I'm hoping that...
You're going to find them.
Okay.
I'll go first.
All right.
Play one 30-minute song.
Then... Love Sparkled High Heeled Boys. And I'm off.
So anyway.
So that's one of my my enforced Christmas joy activities.
Yeah.
Which I'm looking forward to.
It's gonna be great.
I had already agreed to do this.
It's gonna be so cool.
Yes.
Saturday the 14th at the ICA.
Yes.
At 12:00, I think, is when our shift is.
Okay. And as long as we're talking about...
We're tag team DJing.
As long as we're talking about Christmas events, if people are in Southern California this Saturday, yeah. December 7th, I am going to be screening the 1949 film. So yes, it's a 70th anniversary screening of the 1949 classic Holiday Affair with Robert Mitchum and Janet Leigh.
Yes.
The screening is free.
It's a good movie, too.
It is a very good movie.
And it has, I got to interrupt you here, it has a great vintage Christmas tree in it.
Mm.
You look at these old movies, and I've talked about this before. Look at these old movies that are set at Christmas time. You see the trees that people have that they're decorating in their homes, like the characters have a tree.
Yeah.
Trees were wild back in the day. They were like
they weren't squatty perfectly or conical really wide
or just branches going all kinds of crazy directions. They were
drowning in tinsel.
They weren't uniform in shape like they are now. Like they didn't have people like mass producing
them
conical shaped trees. And so you could see anything.
Yeah.
And I love that. I would love an untrimmed, like an unadulterated, like, branch situation.
Well, we got to get in with a tree farm that will hook us up.
Somebody find one and tell me where it is so that I can...
Because you go to the lot, and they're all going to be in the shape that they think people want to buy them in. We have to go to the guy or the lady and be like, hey, don't manicure this one.
Right.
We want something crazy.
Right.
Anyway, at the Fairview Branch Library this Saturday, December 7th at 2:00, free screening of Holiday Affair. I will be selling and signing copies of my book.
Yeah, you ought to come buy that book.
Have yourself a movie little Christmas.
I won't be there. but you ought to go buy that book from Alonzo Duralde. And the event is free.
Yeah. Free movie. Yeah. Buy a book.
And it's a cool movie.
It is a fun movie, and if you already have my book, it's a great gift, as you well know, because you already have my book, and you've read it, and you know how fun it is.
Fun.
Fun.
Fun, 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 fun,
fun, fun, fun, fun, and informative as well.
Yeah. What are we talking about? Is this the Linoleum Knife?
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
So we're not talking about TV, we're not talking about food. I mean, we're going to be talking about food anyway.
Invariably.
Because.
This is the Movie Talk podcast.
What movies did we see?
Well, the two big Thanksgiving Eve openers were Queen and Slim and Knives Out. We've seen both of them,
yes. We stayed home all weekend long and watched The Irishman again.
On Netflix. I wrote a piece for The Wrap because there was much discussion on film Twitter about whether or not one should watch The Irishman on Netflix, how it was affected by watching it on Netflix as opposed to projected, and of course, film Twitter being film Twitter, there was no consensus. There were people who insisted, no, you must see it projected on other people. No, actually, well, Marty had an eye to the small screen all along.
Possible to see it projected in most places.
Yes. This
you
is
have
a,
to be
this
you
is
know,
a,
near a theater that's
a
doing
Netflix
that.
Production. They right. had some theatrical openings, but sadly, most theater chains do not want to deal with Netflix stuff. It's
right.
too small a window. They don't want, they're just not interested.
And you can only show this movie like 3 times a day.
There's that also.
If you're a movie theater and you can squeeze in 4 showtimes of this, then you are still operating on a
morning to midnight
14,
basis.
15 hour clock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, no longer. I mean, 14 hours is just showing the movie itself 4 times.
Yeah.
You know, plus all the between house cleaning
yeah.
and whatnot. Yeah, so like in Los Angeles, American Cinematheque was screening it at the Egyptian, and then it was also at the Alamo downtown and a few other places. New York, they took over a Broadway theater. Broadway.
Oh, yeah?
And they screened it on Broadway. And I think now Netflix has bought the Paris, which was a sort of legendary single-screen art house theater in New York that had closed down. And now it's going to be, they're going to, you know, like Marriage Story is going to be showing there now. You know,
yeah.
it's their venue in New York City. But yeah, for the most part, if you live in the United States, you know, only if you lived in a few certain urban areas did you have a chance to see this movie projected. Like Roma got a wider release than this did.
Yes. Well, Roma was a more normal length film as well.
Well, that, but also I think they were also really trying to hit, Roma opened in El Paso. Like they were really trying to
of
hit
course.
The Mexican-American community with that one as
yes.
well. So yeah, so odds are you didn't get to see, you didn't have a choice. The only way you were going to see The Irishman was on Netflix. And so I was asked to take another look at it and compare the two experiences. Which, you know, then has prompted my Facebook friends to begin their own line of discussion about whether the movie's any good at all. That's been entertaining.
Please detour into that for a moment.
Oh, just,
anybody I know?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And people who are not like, who are smart people with things to say about, you know, the world of the arts, have been kind of not crazy about this. So, you know, you start talking about The Irishman and these are the things that happen.
I just made you pause so I could find out who said what.
Anyway.
Y'all don't know we just took a break, but we just took a break.
People are entitled to their opinions, whatever, it's fine. I love The Irishman and I loved it just as much.
I love it too.
On the small screen.
I think it's amazing.
I don't think it really suffers. I mean,
spent 7 hours of the past month watching that film.
Yeah, there you go. I think obviously, yes, any movie is going to look better projected. You know, like a made-for-TV movie is going to look better if you, on the off chance you can see it projected. But, you know, I don't think that The Irishman suffers on the small screen. And I think I would recommend just a second viewing in general, because certainly for me, there were a lot of things that I was able to appreciate more fully. The structure of Steven Zaillian's screenplay and the sharpness of the writing, like the dialogue is so good. And, you know, there are moments that are sort of like that kind of David Mamet-y, you know, the way like when men talk to each other about the thing that they don't ever say that they're talking about, but you know that that's what they're talking
right.
about. A lot of that. You know, I really had new admiration for Anna Paquin and for the other actors who both play Peggy in the
Lucy,
film.
Lucy Galina.
Lucy Galina, thank you.
I noticed a thing about that.
Uh-huh.
Well, people are not getting the word count for Anna Paquin exactly correct. She says 7 words. Okay. And you feel after you've gotten to the Anna Paquin section of the film, you feel like you've just seen Lucy Galina say approximately 7 words as well. And you kind of do.
Mm-hmm.
Until the scene when she's at school.
And gives the essay.
And gives a book report or some kind of essay report where she's speaking in complete sentences and has an enthusiasm for life. And, you know, you can feel like in this moment, in that little atmosphere of her at school,
uh-huh.
where she can be just herself and not an adjunct to her father, that she thrives in this moment.
That, like, and
she is a person at school.
And that she gets to speak with admiration about Jimmy Hoffa, whom she adores.
Right.
And
I just thought it was an interesting moment where, like, this nearly mute performance.
Right.
In that one scene, this person comes alive.
Right. Even though he's there watching, like, her father.
Right, because
she's
watching. Not talking about him.
No, she's not. Very much not. But yeah, but there's so much going on when both those actresses are conveying so much in what they are perceiving and taking in and giving back with their faces. And, you know, the idea that because they don't speak, that's Scorsese being sexist and not a reflection on the story that's being told and the person who's telling it.
Hold up. Are people saying that because she doesn't speak that Scorsese's being sexist?
Oh, yeah.
But did y'all watch the movie?
I know.
What are you saying? This is... Okay. If you watch this film and you think that her silence is the same thing as misogyny, I assign you homework. Go watch it again. And put down your phone and pay attention to the entire physical person. Pay attention to the face. Pay attention to the body. Pay attention to young her. Pay attention to adult her. Pay attention to this, because this is a performance, and the silence is a chorus of disapproval and judgment and sorrow.
Y'all, movies used to not have any dialogue in them at all. They were called silent films. And that was all actors could do.
We're being
is react
jerks
and
right
look.
Now. And we're being jerks right now, but we're being jerks with a purpose.
Yeah, look,
the purpose is cinema.
Yes. Film. The takes on this movie on Twitter have been flabbergasted. Anyway, it's still great. It's still great if you can only see it on Netflix, you know. But again, as like Dave says, turn your phone off, shut down your laptop, give yourself to this movie. Yes, if you need to take bathroom breaks, take bathroom breaks. No one is going to, you're not insulting cinema if you pause the movie occasionally during 3.5 hours. But while you're watch it and listen to it and be in it. And I think there's a lot that it yields. So, yeah.
Seeing it twice. Made it better.
Yeah. I'm going to watch Marriage Story again on Netflix.
Well, seen the good. And you can sit down with me.
Yeah.
While I watch it.
Oh, it's so good.
I it's playing at a couple theaters here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
But, y'all, I've been making pies. I haven't had any time to get out of the house.
You're underselling. You haven't just been making pies. Dave White... made, and we just did a whole freebie Linoleum Ivan Fork episode about this. Dave White made a whole a Thanksgiving dinner for 15 people.
It's true, I did.
And he made every ding-dang thing, except for the mashed potatoes, which I did.
We've talked about this enough.
Yes. But I just, you know, but it's not just the pies that have been keeping you busy.
I do deserve a lot of praise. Really.
And you've been receiving it.
I did leave the house once in the past. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 5 days. Uh-huh. I left the house one time in the past 5 days.
To go see Knives Out.
To go see Knives Out at the Grove. And and that was lovely. Lovely leaving the house for a moment. But I didn't have to. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't feel like... 5 days of not leaving the house does not bother me one bit.
No.
I can cocoon myself in here for 2-3... I don't go stir crazy. I am perfectly content. I have a lot of things to accomplish.
We have created a cozy space for ourselves.
Truly have. And I do enjoy leaving the house daily. I am not a shut-in, as someone...
He's not.
Rib me about, but I'm perfectly content not to leave. I guess we just move right into talking about Knives Out.
We might as well.
With
sure. This.
I went out yesterday morning. I saw it at 10 a.m. Lovely, nearly empty theater. You go to those early morning screenings. You get just what you want. You get solitude and quiet.
And is it because of Frozen 2, do we think that they're starting the day that early?
Yeah. Well, it's Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, well, sure, yeah.
Which is a big movie weekend.
True, 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 true.
And the theater was, you know, well-populated, but I think they were all going to see Frozen 2.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And so, thank God, you know, I was in a PG-13 or R-rated. I don't even know what R-rated.
It's R-rated.
I was in Knives Out where there's, you know... no children.
The most memorable line from that show, from that movie that is I've already seen featured on T-shirts is a thing we can't say on this podcast. We had to pause again so I could remind Dave what that line was.
Well, but that line is thrown out so jubilantly and quickly, and you know it happens like 7 times in a row,
right?
That you know it flies by. Yeah. Good line though. Yeah. Knives Out is the story of a murder in a gorgeous old it's a mansion.
Yeah, do we call it a gothic mansion? Does it qualify?
Fairly gothic. You know, everything in it is beautiful and old and It's the kind of maximalist inside of a house that makes you think, oh, I've been doing a lot of Swedish death cleaning recently, and if I lived in a house like that, I wouldn't even bother. I'd just be like, oh, I have room for everything.
Got all these wings to fill.
Yeah, nooks and crannies and secret compartments and built-in shelves. That's the dream, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Built-in shelving is the dream of life.
Oh, for sure.
I think it really is. And so the person who dies is Christopher Plummer. He plays an old mystery author who was, you know, a best-selling mystery novelist.
Boy, Agatha Christie.
He's got, you know, a bunch of kids, Jamie Lee Curtis, Chris Evans.
Chris Evans is his grandson.
His grandson?
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
He's Jamie Lee Curtis' son.
Father is
Don Johnson.
Don Johnson and mother's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah. His daughter-in-law of his son who is dead is played by Toni Collette. His son is Michael Shannon, who is married to Ricky Lindholm.
Yeah.
Whose kid is the Book of Henry.
Yes. This is a big cast, and there is his nurse. Christopher Plummer's nurse, played by Ana de Armas, who is fairly new. She hasn't been
much. She was in Blade Runner 2049.
That's the main thing that people know from, probably. You remember her from that film, that's basically her biggest
credit
to date.
But I think she's in the next Bond movie.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So she's the nurse.
Yeah.
And she figures prominently in the film for a variety of reasons, none of which I will spoil.
Yeah.
But they find him with his throat slit. And along come two detectives. One of them played by... Lakeith Stanfield. Thank you very much. And a sleuth named Daniel Craig.
Benoit Blanc.
Played by Daniel Craig.
The police want to write it off as a suicide, but Benoit Blanc has been hired anonymously.
A mysterious cash-filled envelope.
Exactly. And so he is convinced that it must be a homicide.
Yeah. And I'm not going to tell you anything else.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to tell you...
Zip it.
All right.
Zip.
Okay.
Zip.
I won't.
Zip.
I'm not.
Yep.
How to talk about this film without giving anything away.
Well, that's the tricky part.
And I will talk about it in this way.
Okay.
First of all, what a delight. It is 2 full hours.
Yeah.
Of twists and turns and surprises and funny character interaction. Everyone in the movie is giving exactly what you need them to give. Perhaps not in the quantity you wish they would give that performance, simply because as the film goes on, it narrows its focus to a few main people who may be part of the crime, may just be trying to, you know, screw around with people who are part of the crime. And so, for example, characters like Toni Collette and Jamie Lee Curtis, who are, when they are on screen, are on fire. You do start to miss them. You kind of wish they would poke their heads in and say something wacky.
I'm going to say a thing, and you can, if you think I'm giving away too much, I'll go back and delete it.
All right.
I think it is. I think we can. What we can say is that the quote-unquote solution,
yes,
is offered surprisingly early, but it's not. It's by no means the end of the story.
Not at all. No. It's one possibility.
Yeah.
That they offer to you in the middle of the film. Mm. I'd say about a third of the way there.
Yeah.
And then the second 2/3 of the movie is you trying to figure out if that's really what's going on.
Right.
And it might be, but it might not be.
Yeah.
And this film obviously owes a debt to, name them,
Sleuth, The Last of Sheila, right, the original Murder on the Orient Express,
yeah,
Evil Under the Sun, Death on the Nile. And I love those movies, and I like this one. And I wanted to like it a lot more. And I think that part of why people are being super enthusiastic about it is that they miss this genre as something that we got with some regularity.
We used to get a lot more of these.
Yeah.
But when you and I were young,
mm-hmm,
there was a wave of them,
yeah, because,
in the
70s. Because the original Murder on the Orient Express came out, what, 72?
Ish, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that movie was a huge hit and, like, got Oscar nominations. It was, like, it won. Ingrid Bergman won an Oscar for Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it was also the era of movies like Airport and The Towering Inferno. So, like, the all-star cast was a thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things you did with an all-star cast was put them in a whodunit, often an Agatha Christie whodunit.
Yeah.
I think that's a genre that people miss. And I think that because this movie gets so close to being like those movies, that maybe people are forgiving some aspects of this film because they just want
that. What do you think
that
needs to be forgiven? Because you and I disagree about
it. No, I know. And I'm in the minority in this one. Everybody loves this
film. What elements of this film do you think need to be forgiven?
Well, I think the fact that if you're going to sell an ensemble like this.
Yes.
And you're going to make it, you're going to sell an ensemble akin to the way that those earlier films I mentioned sell an ensemble. There should be more of the ensemble in it. You know, I feel like, you know, when you watch Murder on the Orient Express, whoever you came in to see, even if it's like Wendy Hiller and Rachel Roberts, you know, you came away feeling like you got some juicy moments there. But like, I think if you're coming in for, like you said, Jamie Lee Curtis and Toni Collette, for to name a few.
Gaze, if you're going to see this movie for Jamie Lee Curtis and Toni Collette, you're going to be fully satisfied.
Well, savor them while they're there.
You're going to be very happy with what you're given.
Also, I felt like once
they are supporting characters,
once that initial quote-unquote solution is offered, and then the rest of the film is sort of kind of piecing together whether or not it's true and all that stuff, I don't know. It did, to me, it lacked a certain bite. I don't know. All I know is that I went in with very high hopes because, like, the reviews out of Toronto had been rapturous, and I do love this kind of movie, and I like all these people, and I really liked Last Jedi, which sort of put me in a better frame of mind about Rian Johnson than I often am because I'm not the biggest fan of his other films. Except for Brick, which I still haven't seen.
You're wrong about his other films. Looper and Brick are great.
I haven't seen Brick, so I'm not passing judgment on Brick. Looper, I think, is a hot mess. And
Brothers Bloom is real cool, too.
Brothers Bloom has great art direction and one great performance, and the rest of it is kind of eh.
All right.
But Rinko Kikuchi and the Brothers Bloom, I stand for life.
You're allowed to be wrong. Go on.
Uh-huh. Anyway, so here's the thing. I perfectly like Knives Out. I had an okay time. I think it is pretty good. But everybody...
You know how to damn with faint praise.
Well, because...
Better than anyone.
Because I am surrounded by people gushing about it. Mm-hmm. Like, if everybody else hated this movie, I would be like, no, it's fun. It works. It's like, it does what it says on the box, you know? But, like, because everyone's so, like, oh, my God, it's a... I'm like, it's fine. It's okay. Let's not lose our minds about it.
I do not feel like I have lost my mind. I thought it was delightful. I think that if there had been more ensemble interaction consistently throughout and they had not detoured off into, you know, the territory of, well, here's what we think happened, and now we're going to try to either spin that more tightly or unravel it.
Right.
Would I have been happy with more from everyone? Sure. But I do believe that all the parts that interlock here, regardless of who delivers that part, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's really wonderfully, like, tightly constructed.
There's a big plot thing that is like, you have to kind of accept it because it's on its face kind of ridiculous.
I know what part you're talking about, and it's funny and goofy, but it absolutely works because of, well, because of what eventually winds up happening.
Yes, it does pay off, but I think it also demands...
Right, and so it doesn't matter how goofy it is, it pays off, and it pays off in a funny and perfectly interlocking way.
But just because it pays off doesn't mean it's not absurd on its face and requiring a leap for audience members.
This whole movie requires a leap. Because this is the kind of whodunit that doesn't exist in real life.
Right, but I think movies like this, you can create a reality that's about, like, wealth and, you know, who's where at what time and who would have seen this or heard that, you know, that you buy in a mystery. And then there's things that are like, oh, wait, the character has to do this when that happens?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Thought it was great.
Fine.
I had a wonderful time. And I wish I could say more about specifics.
Maybe like when the Blu-ray comes out. And we always promise to do this, and then we never do.
We never do. Rian Johnson's direction is tight in the way that it is with watching Brick. He loves to take his characters and give you little flashes of them behaving in a certain way. I'm still thinking of Megan Good in Brick and how cool she is. Mm-hmm. And I will think the same way about Toni Collette in this film. This is the kind of performance from Toni Collette that it's the most outlandish of the film, and therefore it's going to be the most memorable one.
Sure.
But come on, go for it if that's what you've been given. And she does.
No, certainly. Look, the fact that I want more of these folks means I enjoy what they do.
And he gives those characters, I think, when he shows them to you, I think he gives them great attention and great detail, and they come alive with sometimes very little screen time.
Well,
we've just been talking about Anna Paquin.
Right.
And...
But she's doing more with her screen time and advancing the plot.
I understand, but you know what I mean.
Anyway, look, I'm still telling people, yes, go see Knives Out. It's fun. I'm just not on board with the, like, hallelujah train that has sprung up around this movie.
It's great.
It's good.
Now let's discuss Chris Evans's sweater.
Oh. Definitely did not get enough Chris Evans sweater in this movie.
Yesterday on Twitter, Glenn Weldon, NPR's
Pop Culture Happy Hour,
said that he had to explain the sweater to his family.
Oh.
It's like, but he's rich. Why is his sweater all frayed? Now, this is perfectly... this dovetails perfectly into the discussion that we just had on LKTV about the Ralph Lauren documentary.
Right.
Where... And 1980s, The Official Preppy Handbook, where if you didn't know it before, and at that time in my life, I did not know it. But the moment I read it, I thought, I'll be on the lookout for this. And the moment I became on the lookout for it,
I saw it everywhere.
I didn't see it everywhere. I saw it with the people that would have that sort of thing. So explain
for a moment. It's the idea of you want to dress like somebody who owns a sailboat, but you also want to dress like somebody who's been sailing for years and has worn in certain items.
Yes.
So you don't want Basswegians or penny loafers or topsiders that look fresh out of the box. You want them to look lived in, preferably lived in your, you know, Kennebunkport compound. Like when we were talking about the Ralph Lauren doc, you mentioned that you saved up money to get like a polo shirt.
And yeah, because I was a poor person,
right?
Who's and for me that stuff was aspirational at that time in
right.
my life.
What rich people do is they want to show you that they have spent the money on the Ralph Lauren polo shirt or the whatever thing,
right.
but also that it is of such little consequence to them that it's frayed and lived in and they're still wearing it because they don't have to aspire to anything.
Right.
I think my first exposure to that was when I was in college. I became friends with this guy who had gone to like prep school, like
right.
Andover or, you know,
yeah.
one of the real deal,
Phillips like Exeter, one of those kinds
exactly,
of places.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
And like he would wear, you know, like polo or other sort of Oxford cloth shirts, but like I'd never seen a frayed one before.
Right, right.
And it was like, oh, because it wasn't the kind of thing where like, oh, this is frayed, I have to throw it out now. And I'm like, no, it's frayed, I'm going to keep on wearing it because everybody knows I have a closet full of them and it's comfortable. And I'm showing my disdain for this expensive piece of sportswear by wearing it, you know, in a shabby fashion.
I think it has less to do with disdain or carelessness than it does with
a studied carelessness.
Not even that.
No?
No. Like, I inherited this from my older brother or my father. You know, this sweater belonged to my father. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just how it is, and that's I'm going to be wearing it. And I wear this money very casually because I don't ever have to think about it.
Right. I think if you are a poor person and you have something that is frayed and falling apart, you feel self-conscious about it.
You want to mend it. You want to...
Exactly. Yeah. Cover it up. But if you're rich and you have a thing that's frayed and falling apart, you can wear it and no one's going to think, oh, poor you, you can't afford a new shirt. They know full well that you can. It's sort of like how like it used to be that, you know, being tan meant that you worked in the fields and were like a peasant.
Yeah.
And then it became a thing of, no, I can go to Miami in the winter right. and, you know, lay yeah. out in the sun.
Yeah. Now, look, you talk to me right now. I'm 55 years old. All the clothes I buy are like Brooks Brothers and L.L. Bean because I don't want to wear things that are going to go in or out of style.
Sure.
Because I'm cheap. Like, I never became my youthful aspiration toward being in a different socioeconomic class than mm-hmm. the one I was given.
Right.
I don't have that aspiration anymore. But what I do have is an understanding that to not have that aspiration means I also don't have to care.
Right. I understand.
And so by wearing the clothes for me that are comfortable and again, never stylish, but never not.
Right.
I have plenty of shirts that are frayed and that I keep wearing, because they're sturdy and they last a long time. And I don't actually have anywhere to be impressive.
Well, I think you and I we do the clothing equivalent of sort of not buying the IKEA sofa. And it's not, right. it's not because we aren't thrifty or that we aren't.
No, to be thrifty means you buy something good that'll make it, it'll last for a long time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we can afford anything better than IKEA necessarily, but we save up to get something better than IKEA so that it will last much longer.
Yeah. Which is a whole other thing than I come from money.
Right.
It's, you know.
I don't want to have to think about this again for another decade.
It's like I remember coming out of college and needing to buy a little hand mixer
mm.
for just my life.
Yeah.
Well, I bought a little KitchenAid hand mixer, and it was more than I could afford. But I bought it anyway, because I thought, I don't want to have to think about this again. And that was, well, 28 years ago. We still have that little hand mixer. The beaters pop out sometimes.
I say the beaters pop out all the time.
But it still functions really nicely.
Beyond that,
if
yes.
You hold it the right way.
My other Knives Out observation, just I think is fun, is this has to be intentional. I can't imagine this is not like Rian Johnson making a movie nerd joke.
Right.
Jamie Lee Curtis is married to Don Johnson.
Can you explain what you're talking about?
Jamie Lee Curtis's mother is Janet Lee.
Yes.
Don Johnson's mother-in-law is Tippi Hedren.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
They are Hitchcock heroines in two subsequent films.
Yeah, you're right.
That can't be an accident.
Yeah, especially the Don Johnson
yeah.
aspect of this.
I mean, he is having a resurgence as, like, character actor guy now.
Well, yeah.
But, yeah. Although, you know, it's easy to crap on Don Johnson.
Sure it is.
Did you ever see Tin Cup?
I did.
He's hilarious in Tin Cup.
He's really funny in Tin Cup.
Yeah. And that's not that far off from, like, his Miami Vice peak moment. You know?
True.
So he's been in on the joke for a while now.
Yeah, okay. I guess I agree with that.
Yeah. Also, Dakota Johnson on Ellen is the best thing ever. But we already talked about that.
Did we talk about that on LKTV?
We did.
We did.
Yes.
All right. I can't remember what yes. I've
was
said.
Was it a conversation or a podcast?
Was it something we talked about over dinner or over a microphone? I don't even know.
It all blurs together.
Most of the time anymore.
The other big opener for Thanksgiving week was Queen and Slim.
Melina Matsoukas, the director of this. She directed Beyoncé's Formation video.
Yes.
And she also directed episodes of Insecure and Master of None, which is probably how she became connected to Lena Waithe.
Who wrote the film.
Lena Waithe wrote the film, produces it.
James Fry, of all people, gets a story.
He gets a story credit, story but I don't
what,
know how.
From what I hear, it basically boils down to like he basically told her, I had this idea for a movie and like kind of laid out a basic outline.
Right.
And then she took it and wrote the thing.
I see.
So he's got like a story credit and a producer credit, but okay. It's her thing.
Daniel Kaluuya from mm-hmm. Get Out
and Widows.
And Widows. He is Slim. Jodie Turner Smith, who is a British model and actress, not a lot done over in the United States yet.
She pops up in Neon Demon, right?
Yeah, as a model.
Yeah.
And so she hadn't registered with me.
Yeah,
before.
they're marketing her as introducing.
Right. Even though she's been in some stuff.
It's not her very first thing, but yeah. This is like, I'm sure for most Americans, their first exposure to her.
But when I saw her, the minute I saw her in the film and the minute she stood up and she's like taller than Daniel Kaluuya, I thought, oh, you're a model. Like, I know what you did for a living.
I wasn't sure if that she's taller, because in the scene that you're talking about, I think she's wearing those like high-heeled boots.
True.
So I wasn't sure.
Yeah,
but
maybe
yeah.
she is.
But she's not.
She's tall.
She's tall. She's lithe. She's got all that sort of modely stuff happening. Yeah.
And so they're on a first date in somewhere in Ohio.
Cleveland?
Okay. They're in a diner. They're eating. And they're having... I wouldn't call it a good first date.
No.
I would call it pretty contentious.
It's a little testy, yeah.
Yeah.
Their exchange.
He's driving her home from the date, and she's trying to give him directions. She grabs his phone out of his hand. He swerves in the road, and cop pulls them over. The cop is played by Sturgill Simpson, who's a musician and a writer for Seth Meyers.
Right.
Well.
He figures heavily in Jarmusch's The Dead Don't Die.
Yeah. Because when I saw his face, I thought, do I know you from somewhere? I think I might. So I had to go look him up. They kill this cop.
Yes.
But not before he shoots her.
Right.
And he is about to kill.
Yeah, he shoots her, and then the guy shoots him in self-defense.
Yeah. He shoots her, and then he fights with Daniel Kaluuya, and they're both trying to get the gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, whoever gets the gun is going to win.
They both reach for.
Yes. She's not dead, obviously. She's, you know, grazed in the leg, but it's a gunshot, and it looks bad.
Yeah.
When it happens, you don't know what's going to happen to her. This all happens in the first 12 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
2 hour and 10 minute movie.
He immediately wants to surrender. She says, no,
he wants to be reasonable, but she's a lawyer and she works with,
she's a criminal lawyer. So she knows how the system works.
Yeah. And, she's like, nope, we're running. We're going. This is, you are in no position to negotiate or turn yourself in or anything. This was self-defense, but that's not going to matter. You've done nothing wrong. This person was going to murder you, tried to murder me. We're out. We're gone. So they get in the car and they go. And the entire rest of the film is them on a Thelma and Louise-style journey. Now, at one point, someone in the movie calls them the Black Bonnie and Clyde, but it's not like that.
No.
Because they're not criminals. They're not running around robbing banks for kicks. They are
fugitives.
They are fugitives. They have accidentally, you know, and in self-defense, killed somebody.
A policeman.
A police officer. And now they are on the lam.
Yeah.
So the film itself becomes this personal journey for them where they are learning about each other.
Yeah, this is literally a getting to know you movie.
Yeah.
Because we start with a blind date. Or a Tinder date.
A Tinder date. And they meet all kinds of folks along the way. Her uncle, a mechanic, a guy who runs a diner, like a fast food place.
A sheriff.
A couple played by Flea and Chloe Sevigny. And each stop along the way is another moment for you to rest and for them to rest and to sort themselves out for the next step. The intent is to get away to Cuba.
Right.
And someone even brings up Assata Shakur.
Yes.
In the discussion of Cuba. In fact, every step along the way, the discussion of what it means to be a hunted person.
Yeah.
To be thought of as criminal without ever having been one.
They're asked if they're Black Panthers.
Yeah, are you the new Black Panthers? Questions from all kinds of people from a variety of races, you know, follow them very quickly along the road, as almost as quickly as the cops, because the cops are chasing them every step of the way, and they're almost getting caught all the time.
Meanwhile, the dash cam from the police car has gone viral, and so they've got like all these people who are protesting in support of them.
Right.
But at the same time, there's this national manhunt.
Yeah.
I mean, this is clearly a hot button movie of the now, you know.
Yes.
In terms of dealing with, you know, police violence and it's sort of the coating of American racism that permeates just about everything that happens in our lives right now.
Right. I think this is a beautifully made film. It's, you know, gorgeously, intimately photographed.
Yes. You have two leads, not only two Black leads, but two dark-skinned Black leads, which is very rare in mainstream American cinema.
Right.
And
although it's becoming less rare because of this sort of renaissance that's taking place with sort of new Black cinema,
mm-hmm.
where I mentioned this the other day when I was talking about Lena Waithe talking to Wendy Williams on Wendy Williams' show, Lena Waithe says, this movie is, and this is a quote, she says, this movie is black on black on black on black. She said, we are not code switching. We are not making things easy or explaining anything to anyone who doesn't already know what they need to know. And I appreciate that as a white viewer and a white critic, because I don't want stories that are diluted and, you know, sold to me in a softer way or sold to me in a way that is explaining stuff to me. I want, if you want me to go do my own homework, I will go do my own homework. I always come back to Gilmore Girls with this sort of thing, because that was a show, it was a TV show where anything they said, if it, and it came so fast at you, if you didn't know what was being said, if you didn't know who Henry Box Brown was or Babe Paley, you had to stop the TV and go Google it. Yeah. And so if somebody says something in Queen and Slim that I don't know because I'm not black, it's my job to go look it up.
Yeah.
And I like being pushed that way. Yes. I like being not pandered to.
No, I've always said about movies like this, I love being, that I feel like I'm privy to conversations that are happening when I'm not around.
Yeah.
So they aren't being shaped and groomed and aimed at white people or, you know, lesbians or like
right.
communities of which I am not a member.
Right.
I want to hear the conversations that happen as they would happen. And yeah, if there's a reference I don't know, then it's on me to go look it up.
So I'm deeply appreciative of a film like this that doesn't spell everything out, take me by the hand.
Yeah.
And even when it comes to the emotional resonance of this film, I'm seeing, you know, these characters go through some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not stuff that I've ever been through.
Sure.
And probably never will go through.
Right.
By virtue of the fact that I was born white.
Yeah.
And so I must take the filmmaker's word for it.
Right.
And believe what I am seeing to be the truth. Fortunately, this is such good filmmaking. This is such you know, emotionally, you know, urgent and honest, you know, filmmaking that I got a lot anyway.
Yeah, I mean, as with Knives Out, there's some stuff that I can't really talk about that I have some issues with.
Well, I know what you're talking about. I know what moments in the film you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And those moments are somewhat inscrutable to me, because I don't know why they are in the film.
And
again, we cannot say what these things are because they constitute spoilers.
I'll say this: if just the first one had happened, I'd be like, okay, well, this is going into areas that I don't understand, and there must be reason for it.
Right.
But then the second one, particularly after the first one, is wait, what? So
this is taken as a whole.
Yes.
Okay. All of the incidents, and I know what you're specifically speaking about are two very specific character interactions.
Yes.
That take place.
Yes.
In two different locations with a variety of characters.
Correct.
But if you're taking the film as a whole.
Yes.
There are so many odd character interactions that happen, and you either roll with that or you don't. There's a moment in the parking lot of the fast food place where a series of sort of wacky things that could turn into violence take place. And then the movie goes in this whole other direction with these characters and how they're going to interact with Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith.
Right.
And in any other movie, I would expect there to be, you know, a much more significant confrontation.
Right.
But what does, in fact, happen is something utterly different.
Mm.
So the film is, I think, at many points, sort of confounding your expectations.
I suppose.
And the two that we're talking about that we're not going to talk about because they're spoilers are certainly somewhat confounding.
Fair enough.
The movie keeps rolling, and I think that the reason for this is that so often Black filmmakers, screenwriters, are tasked with sort of explaining life to non-Black people.
Sure. No, I get it.
Spike Lee has talked about this many times, that sense of urgency to get it all on the screen in case you don't have another chance to do it.
Right.
I don't think there's such a feeling of urgency about that anymore. I think that this new wave of Black filmmakers are kind of going their own way.
Sure.
And not asking, you know, not wanting to be, you know, the spokesperson for anybody.
No, of course.
And so, you know, there might be a little bit of the, you know, we got to say it all here right now going on. And if you think that's a flaw, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah,
it is.
I mean,
maybe
it's not. It's hard for me to say.
Otherwise, I think this is really wonderful.
Yeah, maybe it's just a thing that, like, there's a specific intent in mind that I'm just not grasping it.
Yeah.
All I know is that in the moment I was like, first one I was like, okay. And then the second one happens, I'm like,
well,
wait a minute.
Because one of these things is very shocking.
It is. But the second one is not like. Like, if just the second one had happened, I would have probably let it go.
Right.
But the second one is so unbelievable to me because of the first one that I was like,
okay,
doubly put off by it. But again, could be my thing, could be a thing that I just missed. Again, as with Knives Out, I may have some qualms and some things to pick at. You should see this movie. It is exceptionally well acted. I want to mention the cinematographer, Tat Radcliffe, British guy, worked on, he was a cinematographer.
Is everybody British?
You have to wonder.
Associated with this film?
Well, not Lena Waithe.
True.
But yeah, he was the cinematographer for 71 and for Pride.
Ah.
But, you know, I think he really, like, and again, that the conversation that always comes up, you know, the, can you shoot Black performers, can you light it in a way that, you know, that gives them that same big screen effect that white actors get? And, you know, yeah, he's got two exceptionally photogenic leading actors and really, you know, captures them to their advantage. India Moore, I want to mention, great supporting performance.
Yeah. Well, she's wonderful.
Yeah. Bokeem Woodbine plays,
Bokeem Woodbine is so good.
Yeah. But India Moore, like, just kind of sweeps in, and suddenly you're like, oh, could we have a movie about you now? I want to know everything about you.
Have you ever heard Daniel Kaluuya's real voice?
I don't think I have.
I thought he was American.
Nope.
Until recently.
No. That was a
I was like, wait a second. Have I ever heard you speak and sound British?
That was a whole conversation I remember when, like, Get Out happened.
Right.
Because I think what they were talking about, the fact that, like, Selma and Get Out and all these movies that were specifically about the American Black experience were starring British Black actors.
Yes.
You know, David Oyelowo is not from the United States either. And so, this has been a thing that people have been talking about.
Everyone over there is just a better actor. How about that? Come on.
Don't say that.
You know that's true.
No, not necessarily.
It is true. The UK gives us all our best actors.
I know. The American TV is lousy with UK actors. And that's the crazy thing, though. They're so good at American actors. I remember going to the...
Australians doing the same thing.
A little bit. But yeah. It's really mainly the UK. I remember going to the Paley event for Pushing Daisies.
Yeah.
And Anna Friel...
Hearing her speak.
Opens her mouth and just, is all Britishy. And you can tell the audience is like,
Britishy.
What? Like, that does not compute with the
talking
performance
all Britishy
she gives on Pushing Daisies, you know. Also, we caught up with a Christmas movie that I had never seen before.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you've already forgotten about this?
No, I haven't. We
talked about it in the pre-show.
Here's why. I think of it as a Christmas adjacent film. Because it begins at Christmas and the inciting incidents take place at Christmas and because of Christmas.
Right.
But then after that, we just move into, you know, January.
Sure. But, you know, a lot of movies that get categorized as Christmas movies maybe just have, you know, I mean, Meet Me in St. Louis is only Christmassy at the very end, you know.
Right,
it depends on how it goes.
I know.
But this was one that was featured in the TCM book last year.
Yes, but not in yours.
Not in mine. No, I
did not.
Did
you know it existed until the TCM book?
I think I might have heard about it in the years since my book came out.
Yeah.
But when I was doing the research, I'd never heard of this. And this was a pretty obscure one. I mean, it was like an RKO film that had not been financially successful. I don't know what its like home video history has been. But, you know, there were some things that I managed to, like, I remain committed to the idea, whether it's true or not, that TCM started showing Carol for Another Christmas because I wrote about it in the book. But anyway, this is TCM writing about and showing a film that I'd never heard of. It's called Beyond Tomorrow.
It's from 1940.
Yeah.
And it stars the person that I knew, the only name I knew was Harry Carey.
From like John Ford movies?
Yeah.
I knew C. Aubrey Smith.
Okay.
Because he was just one of those very kind of British actors you see and stuff. He was in Rebecca.
Right.
He's in like the original And Then There Were None.
Right.
You know, he played a lot of guys, you know, Colonel Bragg types.
Quite. This has silent film star Rod Larock in it.
Maria Uspenskaya, legendary character actress.
Yeah.
From like the Universal horror movies.
So, it's about three old rich guys.
Yeah, they have an engineering firm.
And they live in a big mansion. They're all old bachelors.
Yeah.
And there's no coding to that. They're just
old bachelors.
Old bachelors who have a very successful and money-making business together.
But they don't have any friends.
Their friends are the staff in the house.
Basically, yeah.
People they've sort of taken in.
Yeah, Maria Uspenskaya plays like a former Russian countess who fled during the revolution is now like their housekeeper.
Yeah. And she's happy to be the housekeeper. She's happy to live where she lives. But it's Christmas Eve and people who were supposed to come over for Christmas Eve dinner
bail,
and they decide that they're going to just try to see who they can find on the street to invite in to eat Christmas Eve dinner with them. So they take some...
they each have these wallets with their cards in them, and they put in $10, and they toss them out on the sidewalk to see if anybody returns them.
And so two of the wallets get returned.
Yeah.
And the, who are these people? Gene Parker?
Yes.
And what's the guy's
name? Richard Carlson. Richard Carlson later was in, like, Creature from the Black Lagoon, speaking of the Universal Monsters. Gene Parker, a few years earlier, had played Beth in the George Cukor adaptation of Little Women.
And I had completely forgotten about her. But anyway.
Neither of them became, like,
Big stars.
But they worked, you know.
This was a B picture.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Explain
so
what that means.
Yeah, I mean, B movie is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but it actually was a specific designation back in the day. If you had a B movie was a movie that was designed to fill out the second half of a double feature. So a studio would send out their A picture, which was like some big movie starring like whatever
Clark Gable,
whoever
Judy
they're like
Garland.
Whoever their big contract stars were at the time, and then the B picture was just sort of there. It was like much lower budget, you know, the cast wasn't as big a deal, either up and coming or maybe down and failing directors, and you know they were like the Ma and Pa Kettle movies, were
mid-level fame actors,
you know, and I mean sometimes those B movies took off or they became kind of series of their own, like a lot, like if you look at the old Blondie movies now, they almost feel like television before television,
right?
You know, because each installment has this like, you know, there's a set cast and set, you know, sets and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so this was a B movie and was not particularly successful, and that's why it was kind of forgotten for a long time.
But it's odd. It's weird and dark and is about death.
Yeah, so the three old guys like go out of their way to bring together the guy and the girl. Like the guy is he's like from Texas and he's a rodeo guy and he wound up staying in New York and now he's trying to earn a stake to go home, and she is a nurse, right?
Yes.
At a children's hospital.
Yes.
And basically they sort of conspire to bring the two of them together. It turns out the guy can also sing, which right. becomes a plot complication yes. later on. And then the three men die in a plane crash.
And then their ghosts, their spirits
haunting the house.
Have to come help everybody.
And they all get called to the beyond, like, not at the same time.
No. You get stuck in the netherworld and you have to kind of earn your last step.
Yeah. So, like, as they're disappearing one by one, they're trying to, like, fix the lives of the young couple that they brought together.
Yeah.
But his head is being turned by this, like, radio singer, because now he's singing on the radio and she wants to use him in this, like, Broadway show because the guy before was, like, old and drunk, but now he's mad about getting replaced. And so he has a tendency to show
There's
up
a lot going
being
on.
Violent and yeah, and the pearly gates, and it's a whole thing. Anyway, look for it on TCM.
Do look for it on TCM. It's sort of gorgeously shot in this almost noir kind of way. Everything's sort of like shadowy and...
Yeah, which might just be a reflection of the low budget more than anything else, but it's an effective...
It still looks wonderful. And
it's cool to see like old movie ideas of what heaven is.
Or how special effects were done to make people like look transparent and stuff like that.
True.
I just was... delighted. I was just enthralled by this from start to finish. And it's part of the thrill of that is stumbling across something, you know, kind of half forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, this is not on anyone's lips, really, right. as a, oh, that's my favorite Christmas movie. Like it's just this.
The TCM app has the trailer for Beyond Tomorrow,
okay,
but well, sadly not the whole movie.
Go watch the trailer and find it if you can. I mean, I bet they do show it on TCM this month, probably sometime. But it's cool.
Yeah. TCM is running a bunch of fun Christmas stuff this month, including a rerun of A Night at the Movies' Merry Christmas, on which I am interviewed.
Oh, who's in that? Who's on that special, Alonzo Duralde? Yeah, when does that happen?
It's sometime like the 21st or 22nd. It's
right, you guys,
Christmas time.
If you watch this special, you will see Alonzo Duralde talking about some Christmas movies.
And looking much younger.
And looking completely different because his hair is dark instead of gray.
I think I have like a little gray for this one, but not nearly as much.
Not
as,
a lot. Not,
not
much.
Nearly as much as I have now.
So yeah, you should totally go check that out on TCM this month. Is History Channel going to show your?
I don't know. The Untold Story of Christmas, or I'll have to look.
You need to look.
Yeah.
Oh wow, this is a very long letter.
Yes, most of them are short.
Okay.
This is another anecdote from the world of movie theater employees.
Got a letter. The long one.
Okay.
From Cody. To answer your question about my last letter on whether or not I'm still working at the theater, I am. But at the time of writing, I was on a break from working there and was transitioning back in. I confused my tenses. Now, this story takes place one boring afternoon of February 2018. Black Panther had just come out to much fanfare. But when you're working at a theater, you quickly find out that the Marvel audience isn't the only crowd to look out for. The Christian crowd can be just as ravenous at the box office, which was the position I was working at that fateful afternoon. Why bring that up? Because the box office sensation that nobody was talking about, Samson, had come out around the same time. We had the parents and the kids going to see Black Panther, and senior citizens heading out to support Samson. I don't remember Samson being a movie at all.
Does not ring a bell for me either. We did not go.
Those were the only shows selling tickets, and after a few hours of telling teenagers that Black Panther was sold out, and senior citizens blessing me for giving them a ticket to see Samson, the end of the set came around and the waiting game began again. Tangent. I hate it when senior citizens bless me, my day, or my life when I'm giving them a ticket. I don't identify as Christian, and I find it very uncomfortable, especially when we are hosting a Christian crowd, whenever they said that to me. Anywho, 2 hours go by and the next set is about to start soon. I see the customers from Black Panther leave the theater, and then the customers from Samson. Let me tell you something. I'm interrupting this letter for just a moment. Our local bank branch always has a person in the lobby to greet you and to ask if you need any sort of special assistance.
Right.
And for a good 6 months, the person who was there, no matter what you needed, no matter what you got from them, no matter what interaction you had with them, they would finish the interaction with, "Have a blessed day."
Oh,
and I'd be like,
"No.
Okay, thank you. It's fine. Well, yeah. Good afternoon to you, too."
I'm looking up Samson on IMDb. Yeah, the actors playing Samson and Delilah, I have no idea who they are. But
all right.
But Billy Zane plays King Balak. Ooh. And Lindsay Wagner plays Zealphinus.
All right, here we go. We're going to finish his letter.
Yes.
One of the people who went to see Samson, an older man who looked to be in his 60s, walked over to me to converse about the film. This isn't unusual, and I started my yep, uh-huh motions while nodding to his thoughts about Samson. And then something interesting happened. He brought up Black Panther. I wouldn't say this man had anything against Black Panther, the movie, but he definitely had some thoughts on superhero films as a whole. Now, forgive me for forgetting some of the details. I do not remember if he had seen Black Panther, but I do remember him talking about how Black Panther shouldn't have been as popular as it was, and that it was a bad film. I kid you not, but this man, while describing how bad Black Panther was, made a gesture where he opened his mouth, stuck his tongue out, and then pointed inside his mouth while making a gagging sound to illustrate how much he hated the film.
Whoa.
He went on talking. My laptop's about to go dark on me here. He went on talking about how the MCU isn't as good as people say, and then compared it to Samson.
Oh, boy.
This is where it gets interesting. He instantly lights up whenever he mentions Samson. I think at one point he flexed a muscle when describing Samson's strength.
Oh!
He tells me with epic hand-waving motions that Samson is superior because the actor was really buff. He was a god, or had the strength of a god, or it was something to do with God, and finally it was based on true events, unlike Black Panther. Based on a true Old Testament story. Mm,
it happened. It really happened.
All through his speech, I kept up my nodding and adding an occasional, "Oh, really?" as my eyes got wider and wider. This man ended his speech by saying that Samson was part of the Christian cinematic universe.
No.
And that it was far superior to the Marvel cinematic universe. At this, I spoke up and asked what he meant, because I had never heard of Samson being part of a movie universe. And so he did. His reasoning was that this was part of a cinematic universe. His reasoning that this was part of a cinematic universe was purely on the end stinger that teased what the next Christian movie was going to be. I do not remember what was coming next, nor do I remember the movies he said preceded this, but I do know that his experience will be with me for the rest of my life. As I ended the conversation with, "I'm glad you enjoyed the show. I'll have to check that out now." I have yet and most likely never will watch Samson, but the movie provided me with one of my most memorable customer interactions. The conversation with the man took around 10 to 15 minutes.
Oof.
While working at a cinema can be stressful, you are definitely used to the customer's verbal trash can more than you'd like. It does provide interesting experiences as a fountain of stories.
Wow. So another thing I learned on IMDb, there are 6 Metacritic reviews for this movie.
For Samson.
All right. The average score being 17.
Ooh.
The 10s came from our friend Ingu Kang at The Wrap, who
good
wrote
old Ingu.
Her quote here being, "The film is just plain bad with an amateur cast led by Taylor James, cut-rate special effects, who cares storylines, and confusing details shoehorned in from the Bible." While Joe Layden from Variety raves, "Even if you're willing to forgive the laughably fake beards, the unconvincing computer-generated imagery, and a man-versus-lion skirmish that might have embarrassed Ed Wood, the overall clunkiness of this enterprise may tempt you to shout rude things at the screen."
Well, all right. I'll never watch this. This is not being watched by me.
Guess what?
What?
We have a Patreon.
Yes, we do.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
You get a lot of things.
So many things.
You get podcasts. Mm-hmm. You get LKTV. You get Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast. You get Linoleum Nights, which is a podcast about whatever we want it to be about.
Yes.
You get items. Sometimes they are mugs and t-shirts and
Christmas ornaments and enamel pins.
Christmas ornaments.
Sometimes you can get a personalized podcast made just for you.
It's called The Private Knife. If you join Patreon, even at the $1 level, you get at least an item, a sticker.
And a daily LKRX recommendation.
Recommendation, cultural recommendations for us that mm-hmm. are only for Patreon people.
Yes.
And we like it when you subscribe, and we try to make sure that you get all the things you need to get.
Yes, we do.
When you do that.
So it's patreon.com/linoleumknife. And if you want a taste of what LKTV and Linoleum Knife and Fork are like, we just released...
A weird, almost not representative taste, but go on.
Well, it's something.
All right.
We just released a post-Thanksgiving special that fused together those two shows, and it's available on our free subscription feed. So
if you're listening to this, you can listen to that. It's all free, free, free.
Indeed, you can.
Yeah.
So, golly, thanks for that. And do check out our friends on the internet. Go to...
Golly, thanks for that. Who are you?
I was trying to make a segue.
What is that? What you just did.
If you're a Patreon subscriber, thank you very much, because I know that Dave can be a lot sometimes.
No, that's not true.
But anyway.
No, it's not true.
Thank you for listening. Let's check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChrissyLemire.com.
I'm a widow spoon.
Go check out Bibbs and Whitney on their critically acclaimed network, The Schmoes Know, Sewers of Paris, Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Deck the Hallmark, All Things Cozy. Like I said, I'll be coming up on All Things Cozy. You can also hear me on, I believe, the new episode of Weird Christmas. If it hasn't posted already, it's going up very soon. And I'm featured on a 6-part series that's part of the Christmas Past podcast called My Dear Santa. That is a true crime Christmas tale. And I pop in occasionally with some quotes with some showbiz lore and history. Also, the Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. And you should totally leave us a 5-star review, because we will read it on the show. Like this one that we just received. Super Bjorn Bjorn writes... Funny and smart, a married couple that are film reviewers, share their opinions on cinema, often funny, full of married life digressions, some complaining, but always entertaining.
Some complaining.
They have a depth of knowledge and a love of film that aids their thoughtful reviews. They're proudly totes on Fleek. Also, they like cake.
No, I'm not on Fleek.
Oh, you live on Fleek.
No, I've never been on Fleek.
You say that now, but...
I said it then. I said it when Fleek was a trending expression.
Fleek coming out of your pores.
Never have I been Fleek. I've been on it, in it, behind it, around it.
Anyway.
Never have been.
Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, including Spotify, which we fixed our feed. I know we disappeared for a while, but you can now get the show on Spotify again.
Did you get like... every episode now on Spotify?
Everyone, yes.
Going back to 2010.
Uh-huh.
Y'all.
All 9 years of this nonsense.
Do you want to catch up? You could catch up, you know. Start at 2010 and work your way up.
If you're having a slow December, why not? We'll fill those hours.
If you're having a slow life in general.
There you go.
You could do that.
So Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, all those places. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments or funny movie theater stories or whatever else you want to share with us. And we'll be back next week with more of this.
What's opening next week? There's a lot of stuff opening next week.
It's
the December crush.
Indeed. And Marriage Story is dropping on Netflix.
Yeah.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire is opening. Yep. And a bunch of cool stuff. And LA Film Critics votes this coming Sunday, December 8th. So we'll probably record after I do that.
I'm guessing it'll be another Monday
Well, we'll see how it goes. Let's shoot for late Sunday afternoon, but it might be Monday.
Don't usually get home from the critics meeting until
mid-afternoon. Anyway, I know. You're like going off to decorate a tree and
at a friend's house.
We'll all be exhausted.
I'm guessing we're going to do this again next Monday.
It is. Don't be surprised if that's what happens, but I will try to keep us on schedule. Because, again, I know the Monday morning commute people are out there, and they look to us to keep them entertained. All right. Anyway, have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time. And until then,
goodbye.